Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This is, of course, a war that has been going on for years, decades indeed. Ronald Reagan described it as a phenomenon that every generation must confront, threats, existential threats to freedom. A man who has lived through and chronicled and helped warn the rest of us about the ongoing threats of totalitarianism in our own time is, I'm very pleased to say, our first guest. His name is Vladimir Bukovsky. He is one of the preeminent dissidents of the old Soviet Union and fought relentlessly against its form of totalitarianism, the existential threat that it represented to freedom, chronicled, among other places, in his superb book, To Build a Castle. It's also the subject of a new book, well, not so new, new hopefully in terms of its English translation, to be released soon, I'm told, Judgment in Moscow. Mr. Bukovsky is a neurophysiologist by training. He spent a lot of time, in fact, having, among other punishments meted out to him by the Soviet regime, time in psychiatric wards. And he has lived to tell the tale, and we're so pleased and so honored, really, to have a chance to talk with him a little bit today. Vladimir Bukovsky, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you.
I wanted to start, if I could, Vladimir, with just a short appreciation, if you would, of some of the horrors that you and countless others in the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire more broadly experienced during its reign of terror, the end of which we all celebrated in 1991, in a fashion. Let's talk first about some of your experiences as they sort of exemplify what went on.
Well, the worst period of terror in the Soviet Union happened before I was born. It was in the 30s and the 20s, 30s. The civil wars and collectivization of peasants, and then the political purges. That was worse. I was born in 1942, so I didn't live under that. But I still had about 10 years to live under Stalin. And although I was just a boy, I do remember many things about it. So that's the beginning. Of course, after Stalin's death in 1953, the regime became softer. The mass repressions, as Stalin practiced, were stopped. Although the political repressions continued, so you would be imprisoned for disagreeing with the regime or criticizing it publicly or telling even a joke about it. But it was nothing as compared with what our parents had to live through in the 30s and 20s.
And yet, what you did live through, especially when you became publicly known to be a critic of the Soviet system, was pretty horrific, both in terms of your time in mental institutions and the gulag as well. Again, not everybody experienced the full horror of all of that, but the repression was pretty awful, even for the ordinary Soviet citizen. But talk about your own experiences briefly, if you would, Vladimir, in terms of how Soviet communism treated those who dared to disagree with its program and agenda.
Yeah, well, I became personally familiar with this when I was 16, because together with my classmates, we've just concocted the school magazine. Nothing special, one copy on typewriter, you know. These jokes about school life and teachers and things like that. And little did we know that the regime would consider it to be ideological subversion. We thought it was a joke. And suddenly, we were all kind of summoned to series talks with the party officials. And I was expelled from school, and I was officially forbidden to continue my education, which actually made me very angry. I mean, it's one thing when you hear the stories about repressions and executions, it's all happened to someone else. But when anything happens to you, it's much more powerful. You become personally involved, and you feel obliged to retaliate, to fight back. So that's what happened when I was 16. That is nearly 60 years ago. And ever since then, I never stopped trying to fight with them.
Yeah. You say that, Vladimir, and I'm sure that it is true in some cases, obviously in your own. But for most people, they were cowed by threats of such retaliation. And the example that was made of people like you and your fellow dissidents, and all for being what they called antisocial elements, I believe, this led to the mass incarceration of millions of people over the years.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In our time, it was not millions, it was thousands. It was small in scale, but pretty severe. At the age of 19, I had to run away, of all places, to Siberia, because I knew they issued a warrant for my arrest, the KGB, the political police. And I didn't like to sit and wait till they come and fetch me. I thought it's stupid. So I used some of my friends who lived in Siberia, and I ran away there and joined the geological expedition. So we were spending half a year in taiga. I was pretty sure the KGB wouldn't find me there. And indeed they didn't. They actually didn't even try to find me. They were happy I'm out of sight, so to speak.
But they caught up with you later.
Yeah, but then I had to go back. I mean, I couldn't live in taiga all my life. So I had to return back home, and as soon as I came, within several months, they arrested me.
You have not only, as I said, Vladimir Bukovsky, chronicled all of this with extraordinary clarity and articulation, but you have also done an awful lot to try to exhume from the archives of the Soviet Union what went on during all of these periods. And when we come back in a moment, I want to talk a little bit with you about some of your insights and in particular, your efforts to hold the regime accountable for what it did. That and much more with Vladimir Bukovsky, the author of To Build a Castle, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
The great, courageous, indeed heroic Vladimir Bukovsky is in the house virtually. We are catching up with him about, among other things, some of his experiences in the old Soviet Union. And we're going to be talking with him both about what he tried to do to ensure that the rest of the world knew the full horror of what that enterprise entailed, and also what it means for our own time, that it was not properly held accountable. Vladimir, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. We talked a little bit about your personal experiences with the Soviet communists in mental institutions and the gulag, as well as sort of internal banishment in Siberia. But talk a little bit about your efforts as the Berlin Wall fell and in the months afterwards to gain access to the archives of institutions like the KGB to chronicle what actually took place during those years of terror and repression.
Well, after I was expelled from the Soviet Union in 1976 in prisoner's exchange for a Chilean communist, I lived in the West, published several books, got education, and so on. And I became pretty well known in Russia. For anyone who opposed the regime there, I was pretty well known. And many of them were my friends. So as soon as the regime was in deep crisis and on the verge of collapsing, I went there and talked to people who were likely to succeed the nomenclatura, Yeltsin and his entourage. Some of them I knew, some of them I just got to know. And at the first meeting, and it was in April of 91, before the Soviet Union collapsed, I already discussed with them the necessity to put regime on trial. I explained to them that unless we go through this process, we are not likely to revive, to recover from all these decades of totalitarian regime. And I was always quoting the example of Nazi Germany, which could recover only because it has the Nuremberg trials of the most notorious criminals among the leadership of Nazi Germany, and also a process of denazification. Unless we have through these two things, the whole country, we are not likely to recover. And I merely persuaded these people. And it so happened that within several months, there was a coup in Moscow with the apparatchik trying to seize power and to reverse the development in the country, as a result of which the country rebelled and the regime collapsed. And indeed, those with whom I talked in April, they became the leaders of New Russia.
Right. Notably, Yeltsin, of course, himself.
Yeah, Yeltsin and his immediate aides and assistants and other people who helped him. So in August of 91, as soon as the regime collapsed, I went to Moscow to see them and renew this explanation that we need to put the regime on trial. We even discussed it with temporary appointed head of KGB. There was someone, Vadim Bakatin, whom Yeltsin appointed temporary to head the KGB with the purpose of dismantling it. And I came in to see him, and our conversation was televised in Russia. And in this conversation, I raised the question of a need for a trial, for some kind of catharsis, which would cleanse the country of what crimes it committed, things like that. And he actually agreed with me on television that we do need such a process. But unfortunately, he didn't live too long in that post. By December, the Soviet Union disappeared, and his position together with the Soviet Union disappeared. And, of course, he had no time to implement anything of that kind. Then, luckily for us, the communists believed that they can actually fight back. And they sued Yeltsin and his government in the Constitutional Court of Russia, arguing that his actions, Yeltsin's actions, were unconstitutional, because as soon as the Soviet Union, as the coup collapsed, Yeltsin insisted on banning the Communist Party, proclaiming it to be unconstitutional. So the communists sued him in the Constitutional Court, hoping that it would help them to restore their previous position, or at least to return everything, the property, the records, things like that. So my friends in Russian leadership asked me to come and help them with this trial. So I did, and by the summer of 1992, I was in Moscow. I was granted permission to subpoena any documents from the secret archives of Central Committee, of Politburo and Central Committee. And I used it as much as I could, as much as time would permit me. I brought with me a small laptop computer. At that time, it was considered to be a technical miracle. It had a hard disk of 40 megabytes. By that time, it was considered to be incredible. And also I brought the handheld scanner, which was at that time still in experimental stage. It was not on sale yet. But I found some people who were actually producing it, designing it, and asked them for one copy. So with this kind of instruments, I came, and having the permission to work in the archives, in the secret archives of Central Committee, I used that opportunity to scan as many documents as I possibly could. Legally, I was not allowed to do that. And the instructions of the time, still in place, although instructions were issued in Soviet time, but they were not changed yet. I was not permitted to copy any document or even to quote them. But I understood that the people would know what I'm doing. You see, this technology was quite new, even in the West. And I reckoned the people, the officials in archives wouldn't understand. And indeed they didn't. I was sitting calmly scanning document after document, and they didn't really realize what I'm doing.
The image of you hunkered down inside the belly of the beast, scanning away when you weren't supposed to be copying anything, is poetic. And so, just very quickly, Vladimir, the most important of your findings from those archives?
I've got a massive amount of documents, thousands and thousands. And I had to limit myself by years, let's say from 61 to 91, because you couldn't embrace everything. It was impossible. There were virtually billions of those documents.
But like totalitarians throughout history, they copiously recorded.
They recorded everything. You wouldn't believe it. In this sense, they were no different from Nazis. Nazis also documented everything they did, apparently for posterity. So I thought the same was happening in the communist time. The leaders believed that these documents would be important later, as historical evidence of how they built socialism, you know. Apparently something like that. So even basic documents were still preserved. In the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, since it happened so quickly, the Soviet regime collapsed in 3 days of a coup, they had no time to even look into the old archives. All they could destroy was the current documentation concerning the coup and things like that. And anything older than that, they simply didn't look into. Luckily for us, in August of 91, the crowd surrounded the building of Central Committee, and it was sealed. The employees were evicted, and the new guards were placed at every entrance. So the archives was in this way captured. They were virtually in the hands of new Russian authorities. Unfortunately, this didn't happen with the KGB archives. We were in separate place completely, no one did anything about it. So we still didn't see any KGB documents. But the Central Committee documents were captured altogether, and I had the privilege of looking through them and requesting subpoenaing documents after documents according to the registry. After some procedure, I would receive copies of these documents.
And for how long were you able to inspect these documents, and how far did you get in that period?
From June to December. And that was as long as the trial continued in the Constitutional Court. I was officially made an expert at the Constitutional Court of Russian Federation by the then president of Russia. So I was kind of the expert there, expert witness.
Vladimir Bukovsky, we have to pause for just a moment. If we can continue, we will do so on the other side of this short break.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're having an extraordinary conversation with one of the great heroes of the 20th century. His name is Vladimir Bukovsky, and we are talking with him about some of his firsthand experiences with the repression of the Soviet Union and then with the effort to chronicle what was involved, not only in his own personal experience, of course, which he's described in marvelous and chilling detail in To Build a Castle and in his new book, The Judgment in Moscow. He is sharing with us some of his insights as he went through the archives of the period from 1961 to 1991 that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had compiled. And Vladimir, I did want to just segue, if I could, from this historical references to ultimately the frustration of your efforts to really put the system on trial. The communists were involved in this lawsuit, but was that the same thing as what you were trying to get, sort of the counterpart to the denazification?
No, of course not. It was a pale copy of it. To begin with, we were hearing the case in the Constitutional Court, not in the Criminal Court or International Tribunal. It was Constitutional Court where the sides were arguing about constitutionality of their actions. The judges would not allow us to say that the Communist Party is criminal. They would immediately stop us and say we are not entitled to look into the crimes. We are dealing only with constitutional issues, and you should keep yourself to that subject. So, the end of it was not anyone wasn't actually punished or proclaimed to be a criminal. The result of the trial was that the Constitutional Court actually took our side and accepted and agreed that the actions by Yeltsin prohibiting Communist Party were constitutional, and the Communist Party itself was unconstitutional in its way of ruling the country. So that was a victory in legal terms, but the consequences, particularly political consequences, were totally different. You see, the Nuremberg Tribunal was judging these people for crimes against humanity. And these people were forever forbidden to take any public office or whatever. Many of them were actually imprisoned.
Some of them executed, in fact.
Some executed. Nothing of the sort had happened in our case. It was a very soft, very mild way of doing things. That was a compromise Yeltsin actually achieved with his enemies at that time. And we were not allowed to go beyond the boundaries of that agreement. We couldn't. But I decided to collect all these documents, knowing very well that in a few months the archive would be completely closed again and no one would ever see these documents. So I was in a hurry. I was working like hell, day and night, and scanning. And scanning is a very painful process. You see, the handheld scanner could take only half a page. So I had later to stitch together these halves into making them into a proper page. And my computer had only 40 megabytes of memory. So every night after working in a day in the archives, I had to sit through the night and stitch these things together and copy them to floppy disks. You may remember at that time, computers had floppy disks. Now they don't. Now they have sticks. And these floppy disks were ridiculously small. They were 1.4 megabytes. So I had to clean the hard disk to reload. And it was a hell of a work. I was just day and night working.
Oh, and such a service. And were you able to get this material out of Russia in the end?
At that time, it was total turmoil. The new power didn't restore certain restrictions. At the border, I could go through with my notebook without anyone checking on it, what I actually have in it. It was, very easy times for these kind of things. I was, of course, risking, because if anyone would decide to check on what I am actually bringing out, they would discover the hundreds and thousands of documents marked top secret, especially importance, and so on and so forth.
And needless to say that they would not have treated you well if that had been the case. This is the kind of courage, of course, that you exhibited, throughout your time dealing with the system, as you call it. And the upshot of all of this was to try to help bring to the West's attention what you had experienced. And again, millions and millions of others in terms of the Soviet system and the danger that it represents, not, of course, just to its own people, but to lots of others. How was this information received when you did make it to the West?
Well, unfortunately, it was received with total indifference. I brought all these documents arguing that the regime is not finished, that we have to finish it off. Without a trial and the international tribunal, we would never finish it. It's a huge system with millions of people. Can you believe it? Nomenklatura at the last stage of Soviet system consisted of about 18 million people.
And when you say the nomenklatura, that means basically the bureaucracy that made up the institutions.
Yeah, the party and state apparatus. Yeah, and it was huge. And it was obvious they're not going to die. And they were still in the same offices with more or less the same duties and more or less the same power.
And absolutely the same loyalties, presumably.
Yeah. So I was pretty sure that there will be a period of restoration. Once we didn't finish them off when we could, 91, 92, they would revive and go back. As a wounded animal, they would be on our throat.
Yeah, maybe undergo sort of a Chapter 11 reorganization, as we call it in this country, but basically just simply putting new names on the old institutions, new wine in old bottles.
That's exactly what happened, Frank. I mean, the KGB was renamed FSB. I mean, not great difference. The same people in the same buildings, in the same offices.
Including people like Putin, who, of course, were perpetuating.
Yes, they were working like hell to return to power and to rescue as much as they could from Soviet Empire. By the year 2000, they've achieved it. They managed to get one of their people to be elected as a president.
Yeah. And Vladimir, could you just tease that out a little bit for us? Because it's my understanding that basically that was an arrangement between Putin and Yeltsin, whereby Yeltsin would effectively be pardoned for any corrupt activities that he or his family engaged in, if he would go along with essentially the restoration of the old system under Putin. Is that right?
Well, the thing which was required from Yeltsin to get this immunity from prosecution was simply to hand the power over to KGB and their people. And he did. You see, after 1993, a year in which there was a standoff between the Supreme Soviet and the presidency, and president had to put down this rebellion with arms, with the help of army. They had to storm the White House and things like that. So after that, he became kind of a hostage to this KGB, the defense ministry, and things like that, military. He was practically a hostage because they actually rescued his power.
And in the person of Putin is increasingly the leader of that faction, right?
Well, at that time, Putin was nothing. He was just assistant to the mayor of St. Petersburg and his deputy. But he had a good career in front of him. He was a new man, not known to be involved in any particular crimes during Soviet time. It was easy for him to pretend to be kind of a Democrat. So he did. And after being in St. Petersburg, he was transferred to Moscow to the presidential administration, very quickly made into head of FSB, the new KGB, and after that became a prime minister very quickly. And then, by Yeltsin decree, he became his successor. It was done in duration of 1 year. It was meteoric.
Indeed, meteoric is exactly the word for it.
Yeah, but in order to convince the population to vote for this new candidate, the KGB organized first the terrorist activities in Russia, blowing up some living buildings, the housing apartments, you know, killing in the process about 600 people. And they blamed the Chechens for that. And Chechens had nothing to do with it at all.
In fact, as I understand it from our mutual friend David Satter, the KGB was actually caught red-handed at one point, putting explosives into one of these apartment buildings. Vladimir, we have to pause one more moment. If we can, we'll be right back with much more.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm so honored to be able to present for one further final segment with Vladimir Bukovsky, a man I've admired tremendously over a very long time, to discuss further with us both some of his own experiences and his insights into the nature of the totalitarian left, the communists, the socialists, the democratic socialists, the progressives, the Alinskyites, call them what you will. He has had firsthand very hard experience with them, and it's an important insight not just for us thinking about it historically, but thinking about it as it rears its ugly head once again in our own time and in our own country. And Vladimir Bukovsky, again, thank you so much for joining us and for your efforts to communicate some very important insights. I did want to ask you about one point. When you were pressing in the West for help in finishing off the system and in getting a trial for that purpose, you, of course, have described the resistance that you found increasingly in Russia, but talk a little bit about your insights into what was the view of Western, not only leftists, but for that matter, the establishment as well.
Well, my main interest when I was reading through all these mountains of secret documents was how much it affected the whole world. I wasn't that much concentrating on internal doings of the regime because I knew about them firsthand. And documenting their crimes was already done by my colleagues in that in the court. So my main interest to find how far they reached in the corrupting of the West and getting kind of political forces of the West and business forces to work for them, objectively speaking. And I don't mean just agents and KGB agents and some other things. That was only a small part of it. I knew that big part of establishment was somehow helping them all along, and finding the confirmation of it every time in the documents was exactly what I was looking for. Apparently, the left, the European left and the American left, left liberal, were very much in cahoots with Moscow throughout the whole period of Cold War. The European social democrats, particularly German social democrats, were practically working for Moscow at the time. In the 70s and 80s, it was difficult to say where KGB ends and German social democrats begin. That was so tight. It was less tight with others, but nevertheless, a collaboration between the Western left and Moscow was obvious and massive. I don't mean only communists. There were communist parties almost in every country, the largest being in Italy and France. Mm-hmm.
The so-called Euro-communists.
But in most of the countries in the West, there were small communist parties, mostly financed from Moscow. And that fact we established very quickly in the documents. That was not hidden in the documents, so we knew that. But it wasn't what I was looking for, because I knew the small communist parties couldn't be that influential. Whereas living in the West after being expelled, I could feel how much forces are on the side of the Soviet Union in a very subtle, very clever way. Not just supporting them openly, oh no, but making possible for them to get out of tight corner every time they found themselves in trouble, and helping them with huge credits and financing, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah, technology transfers.
Technology transferred. And I very quickly discovered that the Western left, and I mean those who were not on payroll of the Soviet Union, who were independent forces, but ideologically they were close to the communists. They were socialists. They differ with Moscow only in the methods of achieving the ends, the end being the building of socialism in the world. So the Moscow part, the Bolsheviks, believed that this could be done by revolution, violently, quickly, and the quicker, the better. Whereas the Western part of it, what we call Mensheviks, the social democrats and people like that, socialists, they were in favor of reformist development, a slow reformist development towards socialism.
Right. Same end, just slightly different means. And this brings us to our own time, Vladimir Bukovsky, and I'm so privileged to be able to, you know, discuss how this relates to what we're seeing now. We have, as I'm sure you're aware, in the United States, not only the people who in the past wanted no part of a trial of the Soviet Union, who have been in some cases teaching in our academic institutions or involved in our popular culture or even in our political life. But you now have a new generation of generally younger people who have been influenced by the work of that previous generation in academia and the pop culture and politics, who are now very susceptible to the seduction of socialism in our time and in our country. What would you say to the rest of us about the danger that such naive people, if that's what they are, or such determined ideologues represent to a free democratic society like ours?
Well, you see, my late friend here in Britain, Norris McWhirter, once defined it when I explained to him the difference between Bolsheviks and Mensheviks. He said quite aptly, it's like cooking a lobster. You could place it in hot water and it will turn red. Or you can put it in cold water and slowly warm it up. The result will be the same. In both cases, lobster will be turned red and cooked up. So that's the difference. And of course, the massive sympathy for socialist ideas is nothing new. The whole thing starts with the French Revolution, with the idea of égalité, fraternité, et так далее, and so on, which of course, totally utopian idea. People are not equal. They're all different. As a biologist can tell you, that there are not two objects in nature which would be absolutely similar. They're all different. Even the drops of water are all different. And the idea that you can make all the people equal physically in the not at the beginning of their life, but equal in the results, is against nature. It couldn't happen. So you have to redistribute wealth, redistribute power and sympathies, and even legislation is in favor of those who are apparently underdogs in their view. And doing that, you screw up the whole system. You impoverish the state, the people, the middle classes. You destroy them slowly. And as a result, the country turns into some kind of a slump. Something we have seen in the Third World where the socialism triumphed, like in Latin America, look at Venezuela right now, the latest, so to speak, the victim of the whole idea. But people still believe in this idiotic idea of equality.
Vladimir, we are at the end of our time, I'm sorry to say. There is so much more to talk with you about, your insights particularly into the seduction of our own people in this era, with some of the manifestly bankrupt and odious practices of the past, which you have lived through and experienced firsthand and taught the rest of us about, is something that we must do a better job of translating to the rest of our countrymen and women. Thank you so much, my friend, for joining us and for the privilege of having a chance to talk with you for this full hour. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.